Hey there, welcome to LSAT Demon Daily Digest. I'm Ben Olson, that's Nathan Fox. Together we're the founders of LSATdemon.com and our weekly podcast, Thinking LSAT. Here's what we talked about this week. We have an email here from Holly.
Yeah, it says, hey guys, I'm a former LSAT Demon student who scored a 180 through use of the live subscription. I applied to law schools in September and October and have already been admitted to University of Michigan and Cornell. Congratulations on all that, by the way. 180.
Yeah, amazing.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Michigan and Cornell, fantastic schools. Okay, good start. I'm sure you guys have gotten a lot of questions about this already, but I'm experiencing a lot of anxiety right now due to Yale, Harvard, Berkeley, and Stanford dropping out of the rankings, that is the U.S. News rankings, with more likely to follow. I'm never going to qualify for need-based aid, but I'm also nowhere near wealthy and I have no family support. I played the game as LSAT Demon recommends. I took almost a whole year of very dedicated studying to get my 180. I'm a splitter, so I knew I needed to score high to get scholarships. I wanted to go to law school for free so badly. Debt is something I've known before and my family is familiar with, and I've always wanted to avoid that and actually be financially healthy in my life. I know it's all speculation at this point, but do you think that other T14 schools are going to nix merit-based aid this year or drastically reduce it? If I don't get merit-based aid, I really think I will just choose not to go to law school instead of being saddled with debt my whole life or being forced into a career I don't like just to pay off debt. What's your advice? It sucks to have this happen at this stage in the admissions process. Thanks, Holly. What do you want to say to Holly about this new news that these four schools, I guess, and more to follow are dropping out? They're not going to participate in the U.S. news rankings anymore. Does that mean that Holly's not going to get a scholarship to law school?
I don't think so. I think that the forces are still very much at play to go up the rankings, even if some of these schools decide to drop out. The rankings are still going to exist, right? We were just talking about this a second ago. U.S. News and World Report rankings have come out and said, we're going to continue to rank schools that don't voluntarily provide us with the information that we've been asking for. So when they say, hey, we don't want to participate anymore, all that's happening is that they are not giving information to the U.S. News and World Report rankings, but they can go get that information, or at least the vast majority of it, from other sources, including the ABA 509 reports.
U.S. News, you know, it's not even a magazine anymore, right? It's just all they do is produce these rankings, it seems like.
Yep.
And so it used to be an actual physical magazine and news organization. Now U.S. News and World Report is essentially, we sell rankings.
Yep.
They have a subscription product that they sell. You know, they sell access to fancy reports online. Okay, so that's what they do. If Yale, Harvard, Stanford, Berkeley, whatever other schools want to opt out, U.S. News is still going to want to try to make money by selling law school rankings. They have this big established brand. There is inertia in the world. Not, you know, it doesn't mean that all of a sudden everybody's going to start ignoring these rankings. And it doesn't mean that these schools won't be ranked.
Yeah,
it would be weird, right? If these schools weren't ranked, then all of a sudden the rankings would be useless because these are the top schools in the rankings. But go ahead, Ben.
Well, you have to also recognize where these rankings came from. They came from a general demand for these sorts of things. People are out in the world and they want to go to a law school and they want to know, okay, well, which law school should I go to? We have a lot of problems with these rankings. We think they're stupid and we have rules about them. We say, hey, what is it? The 2X rule, right?
Yeah.
If a school is, unless a school is within, that's not the best way to describe it. But in any case, unless a school is really far away in the rankings, then don't worry about them. That's what we say all the time. At the same time, they exist because people want this sort of thing. They want to know who's better than who. I mean, that's just human nature, right? Competition all the time. And so even if schools walk away from U.S. News and somehow U.S. News crumbles, another ranking system is almost inevitably going to crop up. I just, people want this sort of thing.
Yeah. So why would it affect Holly's actual life? Like what, or her actual admissions case, right? Like let's think about what's really happening here. These schools are refusing to respond to U.S. News's annual survey. That's what they're doing. They're not responding to the survey. They're not saying, and also you have to remove us from your rankings.
They can't do that.
They could do that. I mean, they could,
I guess they could sue say them, that. But
they could certainly say it. They could say anything they want. They could send them a dirty note, you know, but they could sue them, I suppose. But sue them for what? For putting you in a list of my favorite things? I mean, I don't see how that's possibly going to happen. So they will continue to be ranked.
They will. And some of these schools may honestly decide not to let those rankings affect their admissions decisions, but the pressures are still there.
Yeah.
And so the vast majority of these schools, especially the ones that aren't at the very, very top, will almost certainly still feel institutional pressure.
Right.
To respect these rankings in some way.
Right.
And under the current system, the way to boost your rankings is to give out scholarships.
Yeah. I mean, so Holly's real focused on the top 14, but I think it's ridiculous to paint with such a broad brush. The schools that are opting out, Harvard and Yale, have always been in the top three or four forever. I mean, Yale's number one for what is it now? 19 years in a row or something like that?
Something crazy, yeah.
So Yale already wasn't going to give Holly a merit-based scholarship because they're Yale. And Harvard also wasn't going to give Holly a merit-based scholarship because they're Harvard. And those schools give need-based aid.
That was true before. And that was true for Stanford.
This doesn't change.
Yeah.
And that's true of Stanford as well. And then Berkeley, I don't know what Berkeley has been doing, but Berkeley is a slightly different case because presumably, can we look? I guess we need to look at the Berkeley 509. I haven't looked at this in a while. So UC Berkeley ranked ninth in the most recent rankings last year, gave 70% of the school is getting some kind of a grant. 41% is getting something less than half tuition. But 27% of the class is getting more than half to full. And then 2% of the class is getting more than full. So you get 29% of the class. I mean, almost a third of the class there that's getting half or more of their tuition paid for. The vast majority of that is coming straight from the school themselves. So they're giving now. Is that need-based aid? And they're just calling it, it's like lumped in with grants and scholarships. I suppose it could be, but I don't think that that's true. I just distinctly remember people getting full ride scholarships to Berkeley because they were awesome candidates. That's been true for years, and that has nothing to do with need. It's just entirely, we want, like, the one that I definitely remember is an applicant had a competing offer to Columbia, and Berkeley had offered her $0, and then Berkeley upped it to a full ride.
Whoa, it's a jump.
Or something like that. No, it was, sorry, they had offered her like $25,000 for the first year, and then they upped it to like 50 renewable or something like that. 50 for all 3 years, 50 times three. So it was just, $100,000 that she, and by the way, this was like a 4.0 180 applicant to Berkeley. And they hadn't made their first offer with money. But then when she told them that money was important, or she showed them this competing offer, then she got the full, the full thing.
Yeah.
Berkeley is a school that I know for sure gives merit-based aid. Where were we?
You were saying don't paint with a broad brush. These schools have said they're not going to participate in the surveys anymore, but does that even mean that they're not going to give scholarships? And what does that mean for all the ones that are still participating
Right.
They're clearly playing the game. Yeah.
Let's stay on Berkeley for a second. Did you look up the can you see if they're like really starkly manipulating their median LSAT and their median GPA?
Yeah. So if you if you look at their admits, what is their median? Their median is looks like a 169, and they have tons of people who are getting accepted above 169. And they have a few people who are getting accepted below 169, but not surprisingly, those people have above their 50th percentile in terms of GPA, which looks like around a 3.38 or something like that.
Okay. So here's the thing for Holly. She seems to be assuming that her 180, you know, is now no longer attractive to a school like Berkeley, because they're not participating in the rankings. But just because they're not participating in the rankings doesn't mean that they don't have an interest in raising their prestige in the rankings.
Yeah.
And especially what about schools that are right at the edge of the top 14? Other schools could opt out, but they don't have to. And what are those schools that don't opt out? If they don't opt out, what are they saying?
They're saying they want to keep going ahead with the way things have been going, which includes competing for the rankings.
Yeah, like WashU and St. Louis, I could see them coming with, hey, we've decided to continue. We're good at playing this game and we want to continue playing this game.
Yep.
Although, shit, now that I mentioned WashU and St. Louis, I have to talk about there's news about WashU and St. Louis. If your family income, okay, so WashU Law, full tuition scholarships for low income students. They just sent this out recently. This was sent in by Jet, and also Abby sent this in. They're sending out. So this is from WashU Law admissions, subject full tuition scholarships announced. And this one is full tuition scholarships for low income students. If your family is below 200% of the federal poverty line, you will receive a full tuition scholarship. The financial need of all students will be considered in their scholarship award. Admitted students will discuss their priorities and goals for their customized scholarship award with a member of our team, whatever that means. But the point is, they are sending this out to, I don't know if they're sending it out to everybody or if they're sending it out to people who have, you know, particularly attractive, like they already took the LSAT and they got a good score or what they're doing. But they are out there promoting this new scholarship for low income students. Does that mean that WashU is no longer going to offer merit based aid? I would be shocked if that were the case. OK, that's the news about WashU.
Yeah.
Is WashU going to continue to try to raise its LSAT median and its GRE median or its GPA median in order to rise in the rankings?
Most certainly.
Unless they opt out. And then I can't believe we buried the lead, or I thought that it was a really interesting point that in order to truly opt out, a school would have to be ignorant of US News methodology.
Otherwise, it will continue to influence how they make decisions.
Well, like, we're human and we have motivations, you know, like our behaviors are driven by various things and some of them are subconscious. But if you know that US News does certain things when they rank law schools and you're a law school, it's just going to be real hard to completely ignore the rankings altogether.
Well, the thing is, you don't even have to know the ranking system. You just have to believe that a certain thing is a factor in the ranking system. Have some notion of that. If you have some notion that LSAT scores or GPA or whatever may be a factor in the ranking system, which is going to be impossible for people to forget, then they will consider those things a little bit more heavily.
Yeah.
Every time they make a decision.
Right. And LSAT and GPA have always been part of that ranking.
Yeah.
So will law schools still be motivated by LSAT and GPA? I certainly think so.
Yeah. Holly, sorry that you're feeling anxious, but I think your best shot here is to apply broadly, which hopefully you've heard us talk about that before. And hopefully you did, because it's already November, but and just see what offers come in. That's the best thing you can do. That's always the best thing you can do.
I emailed her directly too. And I said, furthermore, worst case scenario, if all law schools opt out of the rankings and if all law schools, you know, well, I mean, if the entire top 14, let's say, drops out of these rankings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they start ignoring LSAT, you know, and, you know, simultaneously stop giving merit based aid for LSAT, which I can't imagine is going to happen. But even if that did happen, Holly is still the boss of whether she accepts any of these offers. Ideally, absolutely, she would have applied broadly, which would make her immune to shit like this. But even if she didn't apply broadly, she can still just decline all offers and apply again next year, hopefully more broadly or specifically targeting schools that a year from now have demonstrated that they are interested in continuing to chase LSAT scores with merit-based aid.
Yep, absolutely. It would be hard to imagine that the entire system will stop.
Right. Because we simultaneously, and I guess we might as well get into it, we have this other news from the American Bar Association, which I feel like we've had this same headline 10 times, where the ABA announces that they're going to get rid of the requirement that law schools use an admissions test. And everyone thinks that this is going to have crazy dramatic effect on law school admissions. We've had this announcement several times, because first it was the committee that announced that they were investigating it. Then the committee finally endorsed this position. Then that got then it was like, are they going to recommend it to the whole ABA? And what? I don't even know what all the steps are, but finally they did it. And what you said, it's still not potentially done. We have this.
Yeah,
email.
They still have to put it before the House of Delegates. But apparently there's conflicting information here, because apparently the section that's going to present it to the House of Delegates is also the one that has final authority to make the decision. So maybe this decision needs to go through some ratification process, but it's not going to be challenged. I don't know.
Who knows? A bunch of law school deans, like 60 law school deans, publicly opposed the recommendation from the committee.
They did. Yep.
It included David Fagman was one of the signatories on the email. He's the dean of Hastings. We've talked about him many times. We've read his emails and stuff on the Thinking LSAT podcast. And then we just recently talked about Leo Martinez, who's another Hastings guy who apparently is the chair of the ABA committee that is making this recommendation. Anyway, Fagman and 57 other deans said, don't do this because we think it's going to have perverse unintended consequences. It's going to cause people to lean more heavily on GPA, and GPA is even a worse metric as far as being gameable, or as far as being essentially biased toward richer, whiter folk.
Yeah. So people are upset with the LSAT because of its problems with racial differences in scores and so forth. But they're saying, hey, they're going to have to turn to something. And the other things that they're going to turn to, including GPA and school pedigree, are even more susceptible to bias. That's
yeah. It's like, oh, so instead we'll just look at who got a 4.0 from Columbia. Well, guess what? Like, the people who get 4.0s from Columbia tend to be richer, whiter, just more privileged people.
What I thought was interesting too in that letter is that you can always argue, well, look, let the schools do whatever they want. They could look to school pedigree, they could look to GPA, but they can also look to race and make decisions based on that and figure out whatever class they want to compose, right? But the Supreme Court, right, has a case in front of it right now that might remove schools' ability to consider race as part of admissions. And if that happens, I don't know. What are the what's going to happen to diversity then?
Hard to imagine that that would be good for diversity.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the reason why law school is so white is not because of like actual, you know, it's certainly not because of racial prejudice, like intentional prejudice. There's no way that law schools are.
Yeah. You're saying on account of the admissions committees or whatnot. Yeah.
Yeah. They're not operating in that way. They want to use race as a criteria because they want to get more diversity in their schools. If you tell them that they cannot consider race anymore, they're not going to like that because they want more diversity in their schools. So yeah, if that happens, then what do we do to get diversity? I think there's a really credible argument to be made. Obviously, LSAT is correlated with being richer and whiter. You know, like you privileged people tend to do better on the LSAT. That is 100% true. But it also does have a way of letting you find some diamonds in the rough because they're, you know, if a kid coming from a less privileged background, there are kids from less privileged backgrounds that can still come out of nowhere to kill this test. And those students tend to be people who went to some normal school. Maybe they didn't have any resources behind them. They didn't have any counseling. They potentially got poor college grades because they didn't know how to do college. They didn't have, you know, parents who explained to them how to do it and why it's important to get good grades. But they sometimes still do like produce these sparkling LSAT scores. And then the schools have a way of saying, oh shit, okay, like none of your other metrics really make sense here, but your LSAT makes a lot of sense. And then give those people a shot potentially.
I mean, that is why the LSAT was created in the first place, right? Because originally law school applications and admissions were largely limited to the Ivy League and legacy, right?
Yeah.
Your parents come here and what school did you go to? We'll let you in based on that.
Yeah. And so they said, let's do a pipeline type of discrimination, right? Where it's like, well, I mean, did you go to Harvard? And if you did it, by the way, if you went to Harvard, you probably also went to this prep school before you went to Harvard.
Yep.
And so it's just like, you know, that's privilege. And then, Yale Law School. That's a perfect fit for you.
Yeah.
So the LSAT allows law schools to identify some people who might not ever show up on their radar in any other way.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, then they could take it and submit it, even if the school doesn't require it. So maybe it can still serve its purpose.
Well, so let's get into that whole part of the discussion is law schools have never been required to use the LSAT. Law schools have been required to use an admission test. It historically has been the LSAT, but recently many schools allow the GRE. And so what we're talking about here is not just, it's not like ABA cancels the LSAT. It's ABA stops requiring law schools to use an admissions test.
Well, one thing I actually want to clarify there, I think that law schools might have been required to use the LSAT because no other test was approved by the ABA.
You're required to use a test and we approved the LSAT. And
then recently we approved the GRE.
Okay, fine. Law schools were never required to heavily weight the LSAT in their admissions decisions.
True.
The fact that some law schools weight the LSAT five times as heavily as they weight undergraduate GPA in their admissions decision, that's fully their choice. The ABA has said you must use an approved test as part of your admissions, but it didn't say, and it has to be the most important part of your admissions. It just said that you have to use this test.
No, and that is almost certainly a function of the rankings. It could also be a function of the fact that the LSAT is a good predictor of 1L grades. So these two things come together and you can't exactly parse out why a school is doing what it's doing. But when a test, the LSAT, helps you achieve two goals, improve your rankings and increase the likelihood of choosing successful students, it's not surprising that you're going to put a lot of weight on it.
Yeah. And This current new ruling doesn't say law schools are now not allowed to use the LSAT. It, It's just saying you're no longer required to use the LSAT. So don't confuse sufficient for necessary on that issue. Those are two very different things. We are no longer requiring you to use it.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean you're required not to use it.
Yeah. I think the concern, so law schools certainly could continue using it and require it when you apply. That would be totally up to them. It's just that the ABA is not requiring them to require you to submit it. But I think the reason these 60 deans were concerned is that, well, one of the reasons that stuck out to me was, hey, if we remove this requirement, some schools are going to not require it, of course, right? Some schools are going to say, hey, okay, we're done. We're not going to require the LSAT. And then that, as we talked about earlier, that's going to push the admissions committees to look to other things such as GPA. And does that end up hurting diversity? But I think another thing here, and they did say this, and that is that the LSAT keeps people out of the profession who shouldn't be going into it. And if you believe that, maybe you believe the opposite. You're like, no, the LSAT's keeping me out and I really want to be in. And it's not fair. Well, maybe that's true, but maybe it's also the best thing that ever happened to you. Because if the LSAT is a good predictor of first year grades, and first year grades are a good predictor of your success in the profession, which isn't, they're not perfectly correlated by any means. But if they are, then the LSAT is preventing people from going down a debt-ridden path into a career that they shouldn't be going into. Not always. There are exceptions, of course. There are people who suck the LSAT and probably kill it as attorneys. But that's not the issue. It's how many, right? And already schools can admit people without an LSAT score. There are exceptions that are already in there. 10% of your applicants can apply without an LSAT score under the ABA rules. And so this letter from the deans was saying, hey, let's just expand that percentage and see what happens, as opposed to going from 10% to 100%.
The deans have said, we want to be required to use this test. At least those 58 deans,
yeah,
on that email.
Yeah, or letter, yeah.
That letter. These 58 deans have said, we think it's bad if you guys stop requiring us to use the LSAT. Well, okay, so now if all of a sudden they're no longer required to use the LSAT, does that mean they're going to immediately stop using the LSAT?
No, they probably want to continue using it. They're just worried about what that's going to do, right? Some things don't work unless everybody comes on board.
Well, let's think it through, though. You know, like, what, because people are asking us to prognosticate. Okay, first of all, nothing there is happening, by the way, until 2025.
That's the most important thing. Yeah.
So the ABA, this recommendation is slated to take effect in 2025. We're not sure if that's the class that starts law school in 2025 or if that's the admission cycle that starts in 2025, which would then be the class that starts in 2026. So it might not have, like, literally all of y'all who are probably like current law school applicants, or like you're trying to go to law school now ish. This isn't going to affect any of you unless you're down the road to 2025 with the ABA. It's kind of hard to talk about this because it's like all these interrelated issues.
Yeah.
What happened in the SAT, Ben, first of all, was the SAT required for undergraduate admissions?
I don't know if it was required.
Not by any like governing body, right?
All I know is that, yeah, some schools, especially with the pandemic, just started going test optional.
Well, and for political reasons as well, you know, in California, it's just like the people got on the war path of these tests are discriminatory. So the University of California needs to become test optional. That doesn't mean, though, that, again, it's just because it's optional doesn't mean that you don't take the test.
Yeah.
And what did we learn there? What happened? You were quoting stats at me earlier.
Yeah. About, if you're a test optional school, about half of your applicants are not going to submit a SAT score, which isn't surprising. Apparently, of those half that don't submit a score, 60% of that half, or 30% of the total, have a score. They just chose not to submit it. So they're clearly scoring below, right? It's not like they didn't take it. They took it, but then said, oops, I'm not good enough. And then applications ended up rising, especially at the more selective schools, which again, isn't surprising because if you had a low SAT, you're not going to apply because you can't get in, but now you don't have to submit it. So you can feel a little more confident. It could be a delusional confidence though, right? You just think, oh, now I can apply because I don't have to submit my SAT, but who knows how that looks on the other side.
I'm quite sure that it, I'm not saying it's 1,000% delusional, but it obviously would still behoove you to get and apply with a good SAT.
Yeah, when you don't apply with an SAT, you're basically saying, yeah, I couldn't cut it. I couldn't get above your median.
Or I was too lazy to take it, or I come from some, you know, I don't want to be insensitive about it, but came from some underprivileged background where it was not feasible for me to take the test. You know, I didn't have the time or resources to prepare adequately for the test or whatever. That's what you're saying to the schools. But, you know, even if they're not discriminating against you because you don't have a score, they might be discriminating against you because other people do have scores. And it's easier for the schools to assess the quality of those students.
Yeah. And it sounds like some schools are still deciding whether or not to go back to tests required.
Well, originally, so when they got rid of the test,
it wasn't a clear win, right? Like, that's the mere fact that they're like, wait a sec, we'll tell you next year whether or not we're still test optional means that there's problems.
It's always shifting. It's always changing.
Yeah.
You know, that's life. So the best that we know now is, I mean, law schools are still currently required to use an admissions test.
Yep. For the next 3 years.
It's not for the graduating class. It's for the entering class.
As far as I understand, yeah, we can check it out again. I'm pretty sure it's for the entering class 2025.
Okay. So they are currently still required to use a test. They have shown that they are enthusiastic about using the test in the past.
Yep.
U.S. News rankings still exist. Even if a school opts out of the U.S. News rankings, they're still going to be ranked by U.S. News. U.S. News is probably still going to use LSAT and GPA as one of their criteria for ranking schools. It'd be kind of hard to see why would they step away from that. Even if Harvard, Stanford, Yale don't care at all about the rankings and might never have cared about the rankings, the schools on the margins certainly do care about the rankings. U.S. News makes the methodology public, and it's not like ever shocking. You know, they tweak the formula, but they don't like totally reinvent the formula. So law schools are going to know how U.S. News ranks schools anyway. And I think Holly still looks like a badass applicant because of her badass 180 LSAT.
Yeah.
Anything more about all of this stuff? This is like, we're everybody coming out of the woodwork everywhere to ask us questions about this. That's, I think, all we know.
All we know.
You can stay tuned. We will continue to report new news. I hope you will share your thoughts and questions to daily at LSATdemon.com. You can also leave questions in the YouTube chat if you want, or YouTube comments there. We monitor that and we can pick out your questions if you respond on YouTube.
Hey there, welcome to LSAT Demon Daily. I'm Francesca, and I'm here with former Demon student, current LSAT badass, Marissa. Marissa, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you.
Awesome. Marissa, why don't you tell us about your LSAT test experience? Why don't we start there? What happened? You took the test a couple times recently.
Yeah, so I took it in September, and I took it in October as well. I was hitting my practice test scores that I wanted, like mid-August, or I guess it was like early August. So I signed up in time for September, and I also signed up for October just to have it in my back pocket. And yeah, I took September. It did not go well. But I was, you know, I think I was nervous and there's lots of stuff going on. So yeah, I took September, got a 162, and then like studied my ass off for the intermediary, like 4 or 5 weeks or whatever. And then, took October and got a 173.
Yeah. Congrats on that. That's awesome.
Thank you.
Let's back up. Let's go over the context here. Tell us about your LSAT journey. Where did you start? What was it like? What did you do? How'd you get there?
I decided I wanted to go to law school in May of this year. So May 2021 or 2022. And I started studying with another program and this was like Memorial Day. So it was late May, did that for like a week and a half. And then my friend from high school she like posted on Instagram, she's at Penn. And I was like, hey, what did you do when you were studying for the LSAT? And she was like, oh my God, let me tell you what you need to do. And she's like, you need to sign up for LSAT Demon. This is the only way. And so I did. And that was in June. And I did Demon Live for 4 months and yeah, got the score that I wanted.
Awesome. And what was your schedule like while you were studying? What sorts of things were you doing? What were the things that really helped you along the way?
So I was studying probably about 3 to 4 hours a day. I had like pretty flexible work schedule. So I'd like study a little bit in the morning, work, study a little bit at lunch, and then like study at night. When I had COVID, I was studying like a ton, like 8 hours a day, because like I was just going to class all the time because it was my only human contact. But I studied probably like 3 to 4 hours a day on the weekdays, and on the weekends I just got a good hour in. And that's what I did for the entire time.
Yeah. You put in the hours. The big thing there was the consistency, I think. And you probably felt that as well. Like just doing it day in and day out was a big part of seeing progress. And for people listening at home, like if you're doing the live program, if you're going to the classes, typically try not to count those classes as part of your time spent actually studying every day. You know, the 8 hours a day, I'm sure that it wasn't you sitting and doing focus drilling that whole time, but yeah. another way to study for sure. People often ask about plateaus. They want to see linear progress. We want to see that like what we're getting out of studying is proportional to what we're putting in. Did you see any trends in your progress? Did you have any plateaus? Were you ever frustrated?
Yeah, definitely. And I definitely thought I was the only one, and consistently, you know, everyone was just saying like, this is what happens. But yeah, I started out, my diagnostic was a 155. And then after probably like a month and a half of studying, I was sitting at a 160, just like could not move. I was like, I was signed up for the August test before I like even knew about the Demon's like advice about, you know, not signing up until you're hitting your practice test scores and things like that. So I like pushed my August test back. It's like, I'm never going to get past 160. Like, what am I even doing? And I just kept at it, like stayed as consistent as I could. And I mean, plateaus, they happen to everyone, regardless of where, you know, like, and then once that happened, I got to a 169 and I was at a 169 for the next like month and a half, you know? So it's like, the progress is definitely not linear. I probably couldn't tell you what happened, and probably, you know, nothing happened other than just consistently doing the work and learning how to take the test better. But yeah, I couldn't tell you what happened between 160 and 169, but then like, or you know, what happened after that. But yeah, plateaus are totally like totally part of my story for sure.
Yeah, well, I can tell you what happened is you put in a ton of work and you were effective about how you went about that, reviewing your mistakes, big part of it. You got yourself above that hump there, and it's not that there was anything wrong while you were on the plateau. It's just progress is not linear. That's how she goes sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So on the days of the test themselves, were there any differences between how the two tests went, or was it just a matter of one was just not your day and then you were ready later?
Well, September, I was like just in a weird spot also with like personal stuff, but I had been sitting in the same place, studying in the same place. And I was like, surely like this will go how my practice test went. And it did not. There are some extenuating circumstances, and I, you know, was a little bit jet lagged. And so then in October, I thought I was going to completely blow this test because the Friday before, I did like an entire walkthrough. It's like, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to sit in my little spot. I'm going to eat my bar, going to eat my banana, walk my dog, come back inside, you know, have a little bit of time beforehand. ended up breaking the door handle off of my apartment door and had to climb in through a window. I was fully panicked, like just totally panicked. But the thing that helped me the most was definitely like taking a minute and just like calming down and breathing. Like, I'm not the best meditator in the world, but like every single time I was like, what am I even doing? Like, this morning was so fucked up, like all this stuff, like just took a deep breath, took a couple deep breaths, like not thinking about the clock, just thinking about my own ability to answer questions and only answering questions when I was ready to answer them. So I think, yeah, that was the difference. Like, I think I allowed myself a little bit more time to like take a breath and relax in the October test because I like had to, because I was all freaked out.
Yeah, stuff happens outside of your control all the time. I wonder whether part of that ability to bring yourself back into that, because I mean, you were an athlete, right? And still are, still an athlete?
Yeah. Still playing rec basketball, you know.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, I mean, part of that is like when things aren't going your way, you still have to, I'm not a basketball player, but I'd assume like center yourself and be like, okay, like I'm just going to focus on the next shot, the next pass, the next play, whatever it is, right?
Yeah, oh, definitely. Yeah, with this and with sports and with anything, I think having a short memory is definitely necessary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, yeah, not taking in whatever just happened before, but focus on the next question in front of you. Same as you're going through the LSAT. You know, if the previous question was a dumpster fire, okay, whatever. There's the next one. And there's
yeah.
One.
Yeah. Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah.
And I'm also glad that you brought up the point about like personal stuff going on, because like without going into details, I mean, everybody has that stuff going on. And sometimes it's like, why am I not progressing on the LSAT? Why did that test go so badly? But also like you're a human outside of the test and things going on in your life affect that also. And that's totally normal. And everybody's got that stuff going on. Yeah, definitely got to give yourself a little grace there. That's something that we don't often talk about because we're not like, we can't give you life advice, but we can be like, I hope things are going well outside of this test, because that's going to affect how you perform in here as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And like it's the same with like, you know, if you're drilling and you're like, I'm off, I'm having a bad day or whatever. It's the same with like having the same short memory with life. It's like, these things have happened. There's nothing I can do about it. It's in the past. And like, you're just going to keep moving forward with what you've got that day.
Yeah, I like how you said that, having a short memory about it. Is there anything else, any other wisdom that you want to leave for students who are trying to do the same, you know, almost 20 point jump that you did too, that are in the thick of it right now? Like, what do you want to tell people who are where you were a couple months ago?
Yeah, I think the main thing is that it's possible, and it's possible for anyone. Like, I can very vividly remember, because it wasn't that long ago, what before I started, thinking like, all I want is like a 165. I just want to have options, like, you know, but like, don't sell yourself short, because it truly is possible for anyone, like just based on the amount that you put into it. So I think like, yeah, for people who are in plateaus or who are thinking about taking the test, you know, where they're at right now, like you can't sell yourself short, because you can get past. Yeah. Like you can just, I think that this is the only thing. Like, I was a great standardized test taker. Like, that was something that was true my entire life. And then, so coming to this and being like, oh, I'm not like naturally good at this. And like, we were talking about sports earlier, like sports came easy to me. Like these things I expect to be like relatively, I never expected to have to put in this much effort into anything, but like, if you know that this is what you want to do, and if you are willing to put in the hours, like it's possible for anyone.
Yeah. Yeah. And we always say it's the start of your legal career, but it absolutely is within reach for anybody. I really believe that. And I don't know, after having talked to a lot of different students and like seen people's results after a lot of different types of study journeys that people have, one thing that really stands out to me is this idea that there's nothing, you know, inherently special or different about people who get an awesome LSAT score, knock it out of the park. There's not like an LSAT gene that's like, you got it or you don't. It's a big part of it is deciding that you're not going to settle for a certain score, that you're not going to, as you say, sell yourself short. And I don't know, there's this David Goggins quote that I really like, if you'll indulge me for a second, where he says, there's no special people, there's only special minds. It's not necessarily, and he says, and you create your mind. And it's kind of like, there's nothing, you know, 170 plus about 170 plus scores. It's just that a certain approach to studying that you took. And we pride ourselves on trying to help people get that approach and get that good advice and figure out how this test works and then try to fly on their own. But a big part of that is deciding that you're going to stay hungry for that score and that you know that you can get there and you're going to put in the time it takes. So
yeah,
I think it's awesome that you did that. And now you get to take that forward with yourself. That's awesome. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
And thank you seriously for like everything that you helped me with. I got, yeah, it was great working with you and everything. So
yeah, it was, you're super fun to work with. And that was all you. Like, we can't take credit. We helped give you the right advice, but like it, you're the one who put in the work for that. So don't forget that.
We got an email here from VW.
Hey, just a short one since I'm really just on the outside looking in here. On almost all of the practice tests I'm taking, logical reasoning is proving to be the most challenging, mainly because it's hard for me to narrow it down to only one answer. Okay, that's tough.
Yeah, I gave you pause already there because that sounds like you're just doing logical reasoning all wrong in the first place. It's not really about narrowing it down to one answer. If you're doing it right, it's about attacking the argument and predicting the answer, like at least half of the time. And then it's not like this, you know, how do I possibly eliminate these other answers that I don't even understand. Instead, you're like, well, wait a second. I know what the problem with that argument was. And if you want me to strengthen the argument, I'll tell you how to strengthen the argument. And then there's like one clear answer. Anyway.
Yeah, VW continues. On lower levels, questions even, there are some examples where the arguments give way too many answers. No, there aren't examples of that. You're just seeing that in your head. Logical reasoning used to be my strongest section, but it has shifted into my weakest. I was under the impression that the legal field isn't as black and white as these arguments make it seem. But they don't seem very black and white to you right now. You're coming up with multiple answers.
Yeah, now I'm totally confused because if you think the argument gives way to many answers, then you just don't understand the argument or you don't understand the question that they're asking you about that argument, which is very likely. I mean, if you don't understand the question, then of course, you know, you'll have any of these could be the answer, really, or none of them can be the answer.
So sorry to cut you off, but his next question here reveals his problem, I think. And it's what you were already talking about. He says, or she says, are there any tips to pick between the two best answers so I'm not somehow always picking the opposite? This is a super common mistake, right? People get a question wrong and they focus on the answer choices. Like, what's wrong with this answer? What's right about this answer? Yeah. And it's like, hey, you need to go back all the way to the passage when this journey started, because you started on the wrong path and that's where your problem is. But you think the problem is right where the accident occurred. The accident occurred in the answers. So that's what you're investigating. The real problem was you got in the car with maybe a little too many drinks or something like that, right? So it's a horrible analogy, but the problem started back at the passage.
Yeah, there aren't two best answers. There's one right answer and there's four conclusively wrong answers. It is black and white. It's more black and white than you think. The arguments themselves are far from black and white. The arguments are trying to conclude something black and white. And their premises are black and white. Unfortunately, their premises don't really add up to their conclusion. And that's where we can debate these things.
Yep.
But the question itself is going to ask you a specific question. And there's going to be one answer that is specifically correct. There are going to be four answers that are definitely wrong. And it's just not as much about process of elimination. You seem to be wanting to do the whole test by process of elimination, but you're doing it way the hard way. The other thing I want to say is that you're probably almost guaranteed falling prey here to selection bias. You say, I always, you know, pick between the two best answers, but then I pick the wrong one. You say that always happens. You always pick the opposite. You definitely do not always pick the opposite. You're reviewing your mistakes, and on your mistakes, there's going to be a lot of times where you narrowed it down to a 50-50 and guessed wrong. But you're not noticing all the times on the correct answers, the questions that you got right. You tend to think, oh, yeah, I knew that one.
You're not even reviewing them. probably.
Right. You're probably not even looking at it. So it's totally just selection bias. They're making you think that you always pick the opposite when you in fact don't. So two things going on there. If you do narrow it down to a 50-50, I mean, one of those answers is probably correct. And you're probably going to get it right more than half the time. But you're going to miss it half the time as well, or close to half the time. And then, you know, it's just indicating that there's something about the test that you don't understand.
Yeah. So really, you need to go back to the argument, really understand it, make sure you understand each claim in it, and decide, hey, does the evidence in this argument prove the conclusion?
Yeah.
It rarely does. And you have to figure out why the conclusion is not necessarily true, even if it's likely to be true.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've got a whole new class, VW. If you do decide to sign up for Demon Live, check out our class with Kevin called Guilty or Not Guilty. I mean, basically, that's what the purpose of that class is, hey, let's get better at attacking these arguments. Is there an argument there? OK, if there is an argument there, does it actually, you know, convict this person that it's trying to convict? Yeah. Or can we get out of it somehow? And it's critical that you develop that skill. Sounds like you're just starting out, kind of. Welcome. Thank you for your question. Ideally, you know, you're going to find out one of these days how easy the test actually is. And Ben and I will be giving you high fives going, awesome, you got there. It really was this easy the whole time. Sorry you were struggling, but now you just see how you can make sense of it.
Yeah. VW continues. Thank you so much. Demon has proven to be a lot more influential to studying than through other means. And I anticipate getting the live version now.
Okay. So maybe already a live subscriber. Thank you, VW. And I'm sure we can help you a lot. Step one is you really got to like develop an understanding of, what the game actually is on logical reasoning.
Yeah.
Like there are premises, there's a conclusion. The premises probably don't add up to the conclusion. And we got to talk about that before we get confused with the question and all the answer choices. You got to slow down and really get better at attacking those arguments on LR.
We have a longer email here from Sarah.
Says, hi, Nathan and Ben. My name's Sarah. I'm an international applicant who graduated from a U.S. school this May. I started studying for the LSAT from this July for the October LSAT. I was fully committed. I studied full time, which means on average 8 hours a day for 3.5 months.
Okay.
I used PowerScore books and Seven Sage mostly and solved nearly 40 PTs. Wow, that's a lot. 40 PTs in 3 months?
Yeah. Man. I do like the use of the word solved.
Yeah, I agree. I noticed that as well. Yeah, you solved. If you did, in fact, solve each question, then that's pretty good. You're going to be learning through that process.
Yeah.
Right around the October LSAT, I was scoring low 170s, which is around what I wanted. Throughout my LSAT journey, my scores fluctuated, but I expected high 160s from the October LSAT at the worst. This is just people failing to think about their range, you know, that just like, what's your range of practice scores? And you can't think too much about what's the worst I could possibly score, because the bottom of your range is unknown. And so is the top of your range. Anyway. Then came the October test. My first section was logical reasoning. And from question 4, I started feeling like my brain froze. I read the stimulus and looked at the answer choices, and I was not comprehending anything. None of the answer choices made sense, and the confusion continued throughout the whole section. I refocused, and I felt like I did okay on RC and LG, but I got a soul-crushing score back. I got a score so much below my average PT score that I almost laughed when I saw my score. I'm a very driven and dedicated student, so I gave everything to the LSAT. So getting that kind of score really hurt me and left me really confused. Especially, I knew that LR was my weakness, so I did many drills and countless reviews, and yet that's where I messed up, apparently, on LR. My test was undisclosed, so there's really no way to find out where and how I messed up. I tried to maintain the best mental and physical condition, so I'm not sure if it was because of burnout. Now I'm just guessing that I did my LR really badly, worse than usual, and RC and LG were not so great either. So you're really speculating there. I mean, we don't know how you actually did section by section. Still in pain since the score release. I feel like I can use a month-long break from the LSAT and also, luckily, have an opportunity to do so. But I'm not sure if taking a month-long break from the LSAT is generally a good idea, since I will have to put a pause on the flow and restart. I guess I'm afraid that it might take too long to get back into study mode. This worries me, since there are only 3 more international LSATs left in this cycle, and I will only have to take April and June 2023. That's left in this cycle, I guess. I mean, but surely that's not the last test in 2023 for international applicants, is it? Doubt it. That's the last one on their current cycle, but they're going to continue to offer it internationally. Anyway, would you recommend taking a break? ? My goal is at least mid 170s. Is it possible to reach that in 6 months? Given that I have scored in the 170s before.
So, Sarah, you're just doing way too much. I mean, I think there are signs of problems here from the very beginning, right? Like, I think she planned on taking the October test. She's studying 8 hours a day. 8 hours a day.
That's seems like she much. Only wanted to take it once.
Yeah, like, and so it built up all this pressure right into October, and I think that's why she froze in the LR section. We don't know exactly what happened, but if you and I were working together one-on-one, I would say cut your hours down to at most 3 hours a day.
Yeah.
Immediately.
Yeah.
I mean, and there's the other hints, right? Like, oh, I'm mentally and physically, what did she say?
Well, she said
to maintain the best mental and physical condition. That itself sounds stressful.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I'm going to do everything right. I'm going to eat, you know, carrots for breakfast and I'm just like, whatever. Like,
yeah, it's you just can still too much. Be burned out even if you're, you know, eating healthy, exercising, sleeping well, all that stuff. You can still be burned out on this test. I mean,
yeah.
My hypothesis here is that you got so in your head about logical reasoning that you were just doing all kinds of weird shit on your official test. And what you should have been doing is just solving one question at a time, like you did on those 40 practice tests, and just get as close as you can get to the correct answer. Pick it
and stop move on. Giving the tests so much weight.
Yeah. Being on it. Crazy you're giving regimen. Yourself,
yeah, and 6 months, like you the built-in assumption there is that you can't accomplish this goal unless you give 6 months, and dear God, you might give up five, you might only be able to do 5 months because you're going to take a month-long break. That's assuming the test is this astronomical thing. It's not. You could go in there tomorrow and score 175. You've done it on your practice tests. There's no reason you can't do it tomorrow. You just have to completely shift your mindset. Just start thinking about it as a thing that you are good at. You need to get swagger.
Exactly. Yeah. You have scored in the 170s. So you could score in the 170s tomorrow, but you've also scored in the 160s. So you could score in the 160s tomorrow. And it sounds like maybe you didn't give us a number, but maybe you scored 150 something on your official test, which means you can sometimes score in the 150s. Those are all numbers that are within your range, Sarah, and you're really hurting yourself by making so much out of the official test and the results from the official test. You're not treating it like it's just another practice test. You're like, you know, thought that you knew exactly what you could score on the day of the test, and you're just like had this weird floor for yourself. You don't know. There's randomness. You got to do your best on the questions. If you just do your best on one question at a time, you give yourself the best shot that you could. But you got to be able to get back on the horse. I mean, it's insane to think that you now need 6 months of prep when you've already done 40 practice tests and scored regularly in the 170s. You don't get worse. You didn't. Your knowledge of the test, your understanding of the test did not get worse. You had a bad day. And it's because you made so much of it. You made it into too big of a deal.
And the solution to that problem, the reason you scored low is almost certainly because of the way you think about the test, not because of your understanding of the test. So your solution to this problem, which is to go study for another 6 months and dramatically increase your, I don't know, your understanding, is not the solution. Your solution is to stop respecting it so much and just realize that you can own it. It's a mind, it's a mindset change. That's going to bump your range up instantly. I'm not saying these other things won't help. There's more for you to learn and understand about the test, I'm sure, but it's not going to take you 6 months.
Studying 8 hours a day is not good for you. I agree. Boil it, cut it down at most 3 hours a day. I also don't like your full month off. Like, why does it have to be all the way on or all the way off?
Well, she needs that month long break, right? Because she sees it as this full time job. It's like,
I guess,
stop looking at it like that and just look at it as something. Hey, I mean, for someone who's been doing 8 hours a day, I imagine 3 hours a day sounds like cheating. Sounds like,
it's like not enough
slacking, but it should sound easy. And therefore, you don't need to take this month long break. And presumably you already took a break while you're waiting for your score. Let me tell this story really quick. There was a student of mine who kept scoring in the mid 170s on her practice tests, but she took the test two or three times in a row and kept getting 166, oddly the same number, right? And she's like, I'm done. I can't do this test on the official day. I can't score in the mid 170s. I think she had even gotten like 180, maybe once or twice in her practice test.
Okay.
And she said, I'm done. I quit. And I said, okay, look, please, that's fine. You don't have to do anything else, but please just sign up for and go take the test. At that time, it was 2 months away. Go take it. So all I'm asking for you to do is to commit 5 hours, 6 hours of your life.
Yep.
But otherwise you can be done.
Yep.
And she said, fine, I'll do that. But I don't want to do anything else with the LSAT other than that.
Yep.
And she went and she got a 178. She did nothing for 2 months.
Yeah. Yeah. That's like, probably not
and
the
she
best
had
thing.
Been, well, sorry, it was ahead. Good for her. Yeah. It was good for her. And there are better ways, right? She could have studied a little bit leading up to that. Keep the mental muscle flexible. But for her, she had been doing something similar, not 8 hours a day, but something similar where it's like she's doing almost a test a day or something crazy. And I kept trying to tell her to cool it and she didn't listen. And eventually she quit. It's like you said, it's all or nothing.
Right.
And it's like, can we come somewhere in between? And at least for her, it worked out.
Yeah, that's
and then she couldn't stop talking about it.
No, that's fantastic. I mean, obviously, Sarah, that's not our exact, that's not really what advising you to do. We're telling you, though, that if you did not do anything, you're probably not going to go as backward as much as you think. And like, ideally, you would be able to take it again today, you know, just right away, like get right back on the horse and take it again, because your practice tests indicated that you were ready. You happen to have a bad day. You can't make too much of that. So study a little bit between now and your next attempt. Remember that your next attempt is not the be all end all of your LSAT career. It's just another practice test. It does suck as an international student that you can't, you know, you don't have as many opportunities to take the test. I don't know of any rationale for that policy.
I don't understand it either since it's online, but okay.
Yeah. Hopefully that'll change at some point. But for now, yeah, it is what it is. And you've got April and June, I guess. You know, maybe why she's saying 6 months is because she has to wait 6 months.
I think she is saying that, but it's funny that she's asking because it's...
Is it possible?
Is it possible to reach there? Yeah, it's more than possible. That's a long
time. You're already there.
Yeah.
You're already there. So can you be there still 6 months from now? Yeah. You're going to have to stay sharp. I mean, especially if your country is not English speaking, like I would encourage you to immerse yourself in English as much as possible to try to, you know, as part of your LSAT prep.
Although I would say this email is very well written. I don't see a lot of clues or, you know, indications that Sarah is international. So anyways.
Yeah, that's I agree. Well, I mean, she's able to score in the 170s. Normally people who can score in the 170s can put together an email.
Yep.
So it's not surprising, even if English is not her native language.
She has one more question here about tests. Okay, it says, also because I solved a lot of recent practice tests and used nearly all methods I know, I feel a bit lost on how to study further. And since I am highly motivated to get the very best score, I started considering tutors. What are your thoughts on tutoring? To whom do you recommend tutoring? I wouldn't worry about tutoring. You don't need it. You're doing well. And I wouldn't worry about practice tests that you've already burned through. The whole point is to do questions and to learn from them. If you've seen questions before, that doesn't matter. Do you understand which answer is correct? Do you understand why it's correct? Could you explain it to somebody else? If you can, great. Then you're learning something. That's all that matters.
Yeah, we have tutoring available through LSAT Daemon. We have the best LSAT tutors. But we almost always say you probably don't need it. I mean, a Daemon subscription would be a much better investment. It's far less money for far more, actually. One-on-one is a luxury for people who really want to pay an expert on the LSAT, you know, for their time to sit there with you and help you. And yeah, we've got fabulous tutors, but most people are wasting money with tutoring compared to doing it via a Daemon subscription. And even if you don't have a Daemon subscription, I mean, just do practice tests. Sounds like you were making a lot of progress with those practice tests on your own. There's nothing wrong, Sarah, with prep tests 1 through 40. So you've done the 40 most recent ones. Okay. Yep. There's prep tests 1 through 40. You're totally fine. I mean, you've done half roughly of the, not even half of the available tests. So you got nothing to worry about.
Yeah, there's 60 more. That's right. There's 99 available in the Daemon now.
Yeah. I've got an email here from, this one came in through our website, by the way. An email from Anonymous.
The subject is University of Utah Law School, my average LSAT scores. In the admissions FAQ for the University of Utah Law School, it says this: how are multiple LSAT scores treated? In situations where a candidate has multiple LSAT scores, the SJ College of Law will presumptively use the highest score.
There you go.
Okay. The reviewer, however, may use the average score if information in the file indicates that the average score is the most appropriate measure of the candidate's skills. And then the question, I think, from our anonymous correspondent is, what information in the file do you think they're talking about? Okay. Nothing. This is just, again, their sort of way to make the application process opaque. So when you get a rejected or accepted, or your financial aid offer is not great, you have no clue why the fuck they came to the decision they came to.
Yeah.
That's my guess.
It's a non-zero chance that the legal department had something to do with putting that line in there on the FAQ.
Yep.
You know, because if you say so explicitly, we only care about your highest LSAT, then, you know, somebody whose average is better relatively to other people's average, somebody who could only take it once for whatever reason.
Yeah.
They now have some half-assed action or at least complaint against the school to say, well, it's unfair that you guys use the highest LSAT because for some people, you know, that gives you're giving an advantage to people who take it multiple times, fucking whatever. And so then they just throw in there, well, the lawyers are like, well, how about we say presumptively we use the highest score, but the reviewer may use the average score if information in the file indicates that the average score is the most appropriate measure of the candidate's skills.
Yeah. And there's no way to like assess that or judge that.
And there's
you just
no
want to
way.
Do that for everything, because you get thousands of applicants every year. You know, a certain percentage of those people are a little unhinged and they're going to sue for whatever reason they want to sue. And this is just protection.
Yeah. And it's like for the same reason that there tend to be kind of more soft must be trues or supported questions these days than like straight hard must be trues.
Sure.
You know, I could just see the legal department going in there and going, hey, you know, instead of saying if the above is true, which one of the following must be true? How about if we said, which one of the following is most strongly supported by the information above?
Yep. The correct answer is still the same, but now much, much harder to argue against.
Yeah, because your answer doesn't have to be 100% proven. I mean, you literally don't change anything about the question or the answer choices. But now you've got legal defensibility that it's like if someone comes up with a crazy reason why that doesn't have to be true, you go, well, but it's the most strongly supported by the facts.
Yep.
And it doesn't change the meaning of anything.
Yeah.
There's no way the U is averaging law schools or averaging LSATs, right?
Yeah. I don't think so. It doesn't make sense. That's the thing. You're making a decision on the basis of how you're going to make the best class, a student who's going to do well and is going to help your ranking. And what's the best way to do that? Look at their high score.
Yeah, they're ranked 27th in the country, by the way. Their range between their 25th percentile and their 75th percentile is only 6 points. It's It's 159, 25th percentile, and 165, 75th percentile. That doesn't prove it to me that they're not only caring about the highest LSAT, but I think that if they were averaging, then they would tend to have a wider range between their 25th and their 75th percentile high LSAT, right?
Yeah.
This seems like they're gaming the high LSAT stat, which most other law schools do. And especially law schools that are similarly ranked to the U.
Yeah.
Because 37th in the country, you know, you got Davis and Fordham and UC Irvine and Boston College all there tied with you. And everybody wants to get to 36 and you don't want to get bumped to 38. So you have to continue to play that rankings game. Cop out, by the way, for US News to have these big ties in there. I mean, there's so many schools tied at 30. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 schools tied at 30th. And then there's 2 schools tied at 35th. Yeah. And then there's another 7 at 37, 6 at 37. Yeah. Whatever. You know, these schools are fighting it out for high LSAT points because of the rankings. And that's it.
Yeah. Hey, I'm on the University of Utah's website right now. I just clicking through here, looking at this FAQ. And one of the questions is, what undergraduate course of study is best? I was like, well, they have an opinion about this. And they don't, but I want to read what they say after it. They say, there is no pre-law curriculum, no magic formula. It is, however, vital that law students have a mastery of the English language. We look closely at the candidate's transcript. Candidates should undertake an undergraduate program that develops their ability to speak and write about concepts clearly, their capacity to read complex material with precise understanding and attention to detail, and the power to reason, weigh facts, and solve problems. Sounds like the LSAT, honestly. Those are the things that the LSAT tests and reveals.
Yeah.
It's also the things that the LSAT develops if you put in the hard work to improve your score. Anyways, just something we already think, I think, but wanted to share that.
Do you know of a better test of the English language?
I don't.
Even if US News doesn't exist anymore, is the English language still going to be important to law schools?
That's my bet.
Yeah, I don't think anything is really going to change here. I would be, you know, like saying you're no longer required to use the LSAT is not the same thing as saying you can't use the LSAT. You are required not to use the LSAT. And since schools are so clearly interested in your ability to read and write and reason in the English language, I don't think it's the ABA requirement that was ever making schools interested in the LSAT in the first place.
Yep.
Good afternoon, Ben and Nathan. I hope you're well! Exclamation point. I've been listening to the LSAT Demon / Thinking LSAT podcast for a few months now, but this will be my first time emailing you. I wanted to ask a question regarding recommendation letters for the law school application process. Do you think it's a, oh, and this is all in bold. Do you think it is a bad idea to ask for recommendation letters 1 year or longer ahead of time before applying?
No.
I'm asking because I'm considering taking a gap year before law school, but I worry that if I wait 1 year after graduation to ask my professors for a letter of recommendation, they will not remember me as clearly and thus won't write as strong of a letter. So I was thinking of requesting them sooner and then saving them for when I actually apply. And I wanted to hear your thoughts about this.
Do it.
Do it. There are no rules against it. LSAC is not going to take issue with those letters. I can't remember how long your credential assembly service account lasts for, but it's 3 years or 5 years. And you're totally right that they won't remember you as clearly if you wait a year or even 6 months.
Yeah. And we just talked about this on the Thinking LSAT podcast, but basically get the letter now. If you want to update it for any reason, it's going to be astronomically easier for that professor to do so in a year or two from now. They will look at the letter. They'll say, oh yeah, you. Okay. Do you want me to put a new date on it?
Yeah. I mean, although I would never do it for that purpose. In fact, I think it's better with the older date on there, right? I mean, if they're writing you the letter while you're an undergrad, and they're testifying to how you were as an undergrad. It'd be kind of weird to have a modern date or not. I don't know. It's not weird.
It's just not necessary. I think in that context, we were talking about a work letter, which could easily be updated by things you've done since then that would be better. But you're graduating. So, hey, just get it and be done. You'll save it in LSAC. And if you decide never to use it, you don't have to. You choose which letters you will submit to the schools. So great.
Yeah, it can only help you. Yeah, if it's a boss and you're gonna have that same boss a year from now, then maybe don't get the letter right now. But a professor that you're gonna be losing touch with, yeah, for sure. Get it on file. You have to do it all through Credential Assembly Service, by the way. You're gonna have to put in their information and then have them send or, you know, do the whole letter through Credential Assembly Service. It's like a magic link, and you're never going to be able to touch it yourself, but it'll all be there sitting in your LSAC Credential Assembly Service account.
And one last thought here, you may want to give them a deadline, even though you're not planning to apply for some time. Still want to just give them a deadline of a couple months just to get it done. Don't want to say, hey, I'm applying in 2 years. They'll be like, oh, okay. And then it may not happen.
Yeah, you could just say, thank you so much for giving me an A+ in every class I ever took from you. You're my favorite professor. I love you, et cetera. I'm going to apply to law school one of these days. Is it okay? Can I ask you if you'd write a letter for me?
Or just say, I'm applying to law school. Can you send me a letter?
Yeah, the part I wouldn't put is I'm considering taking a gap year and, you know, might not even need this until 2025. Like, don't do that.
Yep, exactly.
Email daily at lsatdemon.com if you'd like to ask us a question or share some LSAT or law school admissions news. Thanks for listening.